Part 1. Early Explorations. Chapter 1. How I Caught Arc Fever. Mount Ararat, Turkey, August 1982. Former Apollo astronaut James Irwin was above a treacherous northern chute high on Mount Ararat when he stopped, unable to descend further. His heart thumped against his ribcage as he gulped in the cold, thin mountain air. The cumbersome metal crampons lashed to his boots had worked great up on the glacier, their steel fangs biting clean into the slick slab of ice. But now, as he was about to cross a boulder field on his way down to base camp, the crampons would be of no use. He sat down on a spine of rock jutting out from the snow and reached down to under the leather straps that secured the crampons to his boots. He was irritated with himself because a few hours earlier he had failed an attempt to reach the summit of 17,000-foot Mount Ararat. In frustration, he had decided to leave the rest of the climb team and walk down to base camp alone. He never arrived. Mountaineering protocol dictates that climbers never go solo, and Irwin's uncharacteristic behavior had surprised the rest of the team, but Irwin was unaccustomed to defeat, after all. He had once planted an American flag in the gray dust of the moon. A rock came loose from above and tumbled down the steep decline, clipping the base of Irwin's skull. He was sent cartwheeling like a rag doll down the craggy slope, eventually stopping on an ice-crusted rock field far below. Unconscious, his contorted body was a bloody mess. Four big gashes gouged his head, four teeth were knocked out, and his hands were cut so severely that they would swell to almost twice their normal size. His entire body was busted up, bludgeoned, sliced, and badly bruised. When the rest of the team arrived at base camp and found that Irwin was missing, they searched for him into the night. Their headlamps groped the crags and sheer drop-offs for any sign of the famous astronaut in the inky blackness. But the terrain was too dangerous and steep, and they had to give up. They prayed all through the long, freezing night and hoped for the best, but everyone knew that other climbers had gone missing on these unforgiving slopes, never to be seen again. When Irwin came to, writhing in pain and shivering from icy wind, he somehow managed to get his backpack off and remove his sleeping bag. Ever so slowly, he shinnied inside the sleeping bag and rolled a few feet to a sheltered spot behind a big rock. Just then, a boulder dislodged from above and rumbled down the mountainside, colliding with Irwin's stone shield. The sound of the thunderous concussion was the last thing he remembered before lapsing into unconsciousness again. The rescue team found him about 8 o'clock the next morning. His sleeping bag was soaked in frozen blood, and the fabric had to be literally peeled away from his body. The Turkish commandos escorting the climbing group knew that if Irwin was to have any chance of survival, he needed to get off the big mountain soon. While several of the climbers attended to Irwin's numerous injuries, one of the commandos hiked to a nearby village of nomadic Kurds living in tents. The soldier frantically requested that the Kurdish elder provide a donkey to carry the injured astronaut down to a hospital, but the elder refused to help. The Kurds hate the Turks and were not willing to cooperate. Enraged and desperate, the Turkish soldier pressed a pistol to the Kurdish leader's forehead and threatened to kill everyone in the village and burn their tents if they would not comply. The donkey was quickly made available, and Jim Irwin was soon brought down to a road where a car was flagged down to drive him to a medical facility. Somehow he survived. Colorado Springs, February 1985. When I first met Jim Irwin, I noticed a gray-white scar above his eyebrow, an indelible memento from his mountain accident 3 years earlier. We were in a restaurant having lunch with a small group of his friends and family. At the time, I was grappling with a strange midlife crisis. I had recently made a sudden, jarring exit from law enforcement after a 10-year career. After moving my family from Southern California to Colorado, my snap decision to quit police work and go into real estate left me badly disoriented, wrestling with withdrawal from the excitement of my former job and yearning for something to fill the gap. But what could place the sense of adventure and accomplishment I had enjoyed all those years as a cop? I eased into the booming Colorado real estate market in the mid-1980s as a private developer. My brother Paul and I carved out a successful business in Colorado Springs. It got off to a fast start and occupied my days, but I still felt a hollow.